people like Taleb are just, it's a lot weirder with them. And Weinstein too. I mean, I honestly don't really know. I think you put it quite well, right? That they have their own, theory of everything or whatever. But I don't think it's even that Bitcoin contradicts that. I think it's almost like it annoys them that Bitcoin even exists and is somehow different to what they've been talking about. Because I agree with you, it's weird, right? That, like, I mean, this has basically become its own meme that everything Taleb has ever said is true about Bitcoin, except the things he said about Bitcoin.
You're listening to the Wake Up Podcast with Alex Fetsky, the place where the most dynamic thinkers and practitioners in the world drop truth bombs and contrarian viewpoints to help you become the best version of yourself. Find us on the Fountain app and send us a boost with a comment. Your piece was entitled, at least for the Bitcoin Times, it was entitled The Separation of Money and State. Is that the same title as the...
I think so, yeah. I think that's the name of the section of the book, yeah.
Okay, cool. So I wrote this five-part series for Bitcoin Magazine, which I think I'll probably also kind of like work on a little bit further and try and turn into a book and maybe do my own Alan Farrington impersonation. But
I give it to a bunch of celebrities who won't read it.
Basically, exactly. That's the plan. It was called the Bitcoin is Not Democratic series. And I ripped off Hopper, right? And that was kind of like the part one and part two was Democracy the God That Failed.
Like what, Bitcoin the God That Succeeded or something.
Yeah, something like that. That's maybe what I should call it. But
yeah, you want to offend as many people as possible with one title.
Yeah, exactly. That's a fucking great idea. Part three of this series was called The Separation of Economy and Politics. So it was kind of an attempt to make the claim and basically, do a variation on the idea of the separation of money and state, is that economics and politics seem to have this vicious relationship when one can really affect the other. And I don't think we'll ever have a complete separation of the two, because in some way
they're
inextricably linked. But what's interesting is Gladstein and I had a quote-unquote debate after I wrote the first piece, Bitcoin is Not Democratic. And as we were debating, something came up and Gladstein was like, you know, the problem we have I can't remember if it was he said it, I said it, one of us fucking said something. It was to do with the fact that when you can amass economic power initially, you can kind of, move your way into political power. And this is basically what Rockefeller did, right? He did something incredible with the ability to extract and transport oil and to do everything that he did with Standard Oil. But where the wheels came off was that he then used that economic influence to enter the political realm and then used that to gain political favors, which inherently gave him a further economic advantage. Mm-hmm. And that kind of vicious cycle kind of happened. And it gets worse when you have a situation where you can actually change the economic rules, and the most important economic rule of all is like, what is money, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how do we actually measure, what's the scorecard by which we measure our economy? So Bitcoin seems, though, to break that chain, at least, in the sense that you may amass economic power. And, a lot of people actually question this. It's like, okay, well, what's going to happen in the future when this sort of group of Bitcoiners has all the Bitcoin, right? There is going to be a disproportionate
number. We're going to commission beautiful public art everywhere.
Apparently, right? Or we're going to...
Having first paid for all the disgusting shit to be knocked down.
But I guess I try and answer that by saying that, look, even though some of us will have a disproportionate amount of Bitcoin, the thing that we can't do is maybe in a local sense, we might be able to amass some level of political power, but we'll still be impotent in an economic rules.
Yeah,
sense.
I see what you mean by that. Yeah.
So maybe we can talk about this because I think that's mm-hmm. a big idea. I think the separation of economics and politics, or at least the, you know, some sort of membrane between the two that, you know, Bitcoin may exist as, I think is such a fucking long-term powerful impact. Like for me, it kind of, it's in the realm of, you know, Bitcoin as economic consequence. Like those two ideas, I think, are very powerful. So I wonder if you can riff on that.
Yeah, I have a couple of thoughts on this. The first one actually is, I feel like it's almost just countering FUD. Like I feel like if you hear this point about, oh, what happens when, you know, it's just the OG Bitcoiners who are like super duper rich. This honestly just doesn't bother me at all, because that will only be true for a short period, and then it will never, ever be true again. Like it's so much unimaginably better than what we have now, which is kind of a crude generalization of it, I guess. But, you know, there's always a kind of a corrupt, to some or other extent, or like in some or other way, corrupt, parasitic upper class. All that changes is who's in it, and, you know, just like people just revolve through it, as the political access to economic means changes hands. Whereas what we're talking about now is, okay, yes, I think you do have to admit it's a more extreme distribution of wealth than we are used to, but it's not corrupt. So that's an important ethical point to make. It's like none of these people stole their Bitcoin, as far as we know, right? Maybe some of them did if they, like, I don't know, hacked an exchange or something, but like most of them didn't, right? Most of them just bought it early, right? They took a risk. They took a kind of borderline entrepreneurial risk. So that's an important point. But I think the far, far more important one is that the mechanics are fundamentally different. And so it's constantly changing too. This is the other thing that I don't like. You can probably tell by the way I'm even talking about it, I don't really see that much merit in even observing, never mind complaining, what the wealth distribution is. But it's just like an objective fact, never mind something you need to moralize about, that it's getting better. Well, better, it's getting more distributed far faster than any alternate monetary system that you can like make a similar comparison to. So like it will eventually get to, you know, a point when basically the starting point that you mentioned just isn't true anymore anyway, and then it will be fair forever. So that's fine. So I just want to get that out of the way. I don't know, do you have a reaction?
Yeah. I just have one thing to say to that. It's like NVK calls it the final Cantillon effect. Like,
yeah, that's good actually. I like that. I never heard him say that before, but yeah, I like, get it.
Yeah, it's the last one. That's it. So, you know, if you're lucky enough to realize that, you know, you'll be able to amass it. And I mean, I also think, and me and Knut talked about this, is like, I actually think that a lot of the early holders, basically they end up going to lose their Bitcoin or not be able to pass it on or fuck something up along the way. So in many ways, I don't know how many, like 50 or 100 years from now, I don't know how many real major OG types are still going to be around. Like, like imagine you're a nerd that bought Bitcoin really early, and you like have zero social sense and you don't know how to do anything. So, you know, you end up with no kids and like, what happens to your Bitcoin? Nothing.
It's loads of Lambos.
That's basically all it turns into. So it's a, I don't know, that's part of a bigger thing, but yeah, I think the being the final Cantillon effect, I think, is a really good way of
I've just realized now that there, you can maybe tug at this even further, which is that there's kind of an unstated or an unassumed premise in all of this, that having wealth or having disproportionate wealth within the broader distribution, I don't know, I guess implies you will spend it or something like that, which I think with Bitcoin is probably far less likely to be true than normal, right? I would have thought that most OG Bitcoiners, and keep in mind, like, you know, one day in another 10, 20 years, we'll be in that position too. Like, just relatively speaking, by the time everyone catches up, like, I live very frugally. Like, I have very low time preference. Like, I honestly don't think it's going to matter at all. Like, who's going to care? Who's even going to know if I don't go and buy Lambos? Like, what does it matter? I'm helping everyone else. Basically, I'm just causing deflation. Mm-hmm. You're all very welcome.
Yeah. Yeah. That
keep actually, in mind, you know, like, I don't mean this just as it is partly a joke, but that's not at all the case now, because you have to spend it. So it does matter now how unequal. Again, it's not something I like complaining about that much, but insofar as you can point to it as being like a cantillionaire privilege, it is absolutely worth complaining about. But the consequence of that is, well, I mean, there's loads of horrible consequences of it. Not only do they need to spend it, but them spending it has these, you know, second, third order social effects, like monetizing real estate and, you know, all that kind of thing, that is like, they're objectively bad. Whereas me just like not ever spending my Bitcoin and then it stays in my dynasty for 20 generations or what, like that's fine. It doesn't matter.
That's actually good. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's such a flip on how people understand the rich getting richer, poor getting poorer piece now. It's like, So anyway, that's such a good point. What else did you have to say about
separation of economy and politics? Disconnecting politics and economics, right? The other thing I did want to point out, though, is you didn't do this, to be clear, but I think some people will. I wouldn't want to get too excited about, oh, they will just have nothing to do with one another anymore. Like, you just won't be able to buy influence or something like that.
That's bullshit.
I find that kind of silly. And I think actually, if anything, it maybe goes back to something we were talking about a while ago, that the ultimate source of that just not being true is really got nothing to do with economics, and it's barely to do with politics either. It's just a frank recognition of what living in a community actually entails. Like, you have to deal with other people. There will be, I don't mean the following in like a, you know, promoting any particular political philosophy or anything, but there will be governance. I don't know what that means, right? It almost doesn't matter what it means. It's just, there will be a decision-making process by which we all decide how to live together, right? Something like that. I think that's vague enough that no one will get upset with it. And the idea that, first of all, you can escape that unless you literally just want to go live in the woods, which I don't, because I like, you know, civilization. I like this is maybe an interesting segue to pushing this argument even further. I like the product of capital accumulation, which is again, is necessarily social, because completely relies on a division of labor. Unless you want that, which I think the vast majority of people don't, you do need to work out how to live with other people. You do need to restrain your own freedom on the assumption that others will reciprocate that. And I think also, like, you know, if there is money, especially if there's really, really good money, you can bribe people. It's just like, that's just a fact of life. So yeah, I just wanted to have kind of a word of caution on that, that there's, I think it's even in this extract, I won't read through it to find the quote now, but there is a line that's something to the effect of like, it doesn't usher in a pacifist utopia. It just, you know, it gives you far healthier conditions for relating wealth and politics, I think.
Totally. I think
explore some of them too.
Yeah. Clubs, cliques, and backroom deals and all that sort of stuff are going to exist forever. I think the big takeaway idea is that you can't change the scorecard. So if you have the ability to gain influence, like, you're still going to do it. And there's still going to be alliances. There's still going to be advantages. There's still going to be all sorts of stuff like that, which, I mean, sometimes that stuff can get a little bit deranged, right? Like, there can be some, you know, quote unquote, bad repercussions, I guess, from those sorts of things happening. But you can't avoid that. Like,
it's got nothing to do with economics, basically. Yeah, it's like the reality of social life.
Exactly. By creating some sort of regulatory organization to try and mitigate the ability for backroom deals to happen. All you do is you push the backroom deals into the regulatory organization does that. So all the criminals go to where it's, you know, the legal loophole, the legal vacuum in order to do that. That's why all the best criminals today are in fucking government and central banking. They're no longer in gangs.
Well, you never go to jail that way, do you?
Yeah, that's it. You know, it's just all with, and this is what, you know, people like Peter McCormack, I think, seem to misunderstand. They're like, it's like, well, who's going to govern people? It's like, well, no. When you create the monopoly on it, like everyone, like the most adept criminals know exactly where to go.
Yeah. Which is, again, this is really nice link to why localism matters. I think this time in an overtly political sense, that you are far more likely to make some minor sacrifice for many people to make some perceived to be minor sacrifice, such that living together is actually tolerable in the first place, if you all know each other. Or you know, you got to maybe scale it a bit beyond like literally who do you know personally, but basically the more local, the better. Because I think exactly what you just described, right? That is a product of feeling like part of a community that is, or a political entity, if you want to, maybe that's a better way of framing it, that is basically so big that it you don't care who you screw. Like it makes absolutely no difference to you because you don't know them and you don't see it. And you maybe even have in the back of your mind, well, if I don't do this, someone else will do it. And then I'll be the one getting screwed.
100%. I used to have a friend who, when they released the self-service checkouts in Australia, like at there's like two big supermarket chains, mm-hmm. Woolworths and Coles. And in the beginning, they didn't have the sensors or anything like that. So what people would do is like they'd buy whatever they want and they'd just click brown onions every single time because that was like the cheapest thing. But what's funny, so this friend of mine was like, you know, everything's brown onions, and but he would only do that at Woolworths because he's like, oh, they're big, that I don't give a fuck. Whereas he'd never do that at a local store. So when he had spent real money, he went to the local store and like he spent actual money there.
That's like I think that's really fascinating because on the one hand, you know, you can look at his argument in kind of like, I don't know, almost autistically logical terms, right? And be like, no, that's irrational. Let's do the math, right? Like somebody is, blah, blah, blah. But I think the more profound lesson there is that, you know, this is like a real person who actually thought this is how people behave. It's, you know, they're not logical autists, basically.
Totally, totally.
Which is, I think on like net is a good thing, right?
Yeah, it's just interesting how that, like this weird moral logical justification for, you know, I'm helping the local guy but fuck the big guy. So it's a that's an interesting
there's another completely different angle, I think, as like a more positive one now that maybe is worth exploring around how this I think is new, like it's fundamentally it's a novel circumstance in the relation between, let's say, politics and economics, which is how mobile capital has become. So I think this is really fascinating. I don't think, if I remember correctly, I don't think we really go into this in this extract, but we do a lot in the rest of the chapter. And then there's a few other places in the book. And you've read Bitcoin is Venice, so you know it comes up a few times there. I think that's enormous because there's currently, and you probably want to link this to toxic bigness too, I guess, an enormous amount of, let's say, unhealthy or even kind of extractive politics would never be articulated this way because it almost seems so obvious, but it's predicated on immobile capital that you don't even need to really steal it because the threat of stealing it is so overwhelming and like so obviously going to succeed that people will just capitulate beforehand anyway. Whereas now, I think in more than one way, so the obvious way is just, oh, people, like all their wealth is in their heads, right? They're not going to get their bank accounts confiscated or something like that. I think we're going to start to see subtler forms of this too, in that a lot of Bitcoin companies, I mean, one day they'll just be companies, right? But you know, now Bitcoin companies, their wealth, their, you know, the value of their capital is I guess there's a few different ways you can think about it. It's inherently mostly software or human capital. And I think in both cases, it's tied up with its ability to manipulate Bitcoin in the first place. And both of those are perfectly mobile. So if you live somewhere where, and this maybe feeds into the core thesis, although, well, he didn't say this himself because it's, again, the most hilarious chapter ever. He's just like, nope, never going to happen. But I disagree. Like, there needs to be an updated version of this book where, like, no, actually, this might now happen. Because if the politics gets too, offensive or annoying or, you know, whatever, for whatever reason you don't like it, you can just leave. And it's so much easier, or it will be so much easier than it ever has been in the past. And I would also expect that this starts to feed back on what the politics even is in the first place. I think it goes into reverse. So in the previous situation where they don't even need to actually take your stuff because the threat of taking your stuff is enough because you know they'll succeed, you now get the opposite of that, which is you don't need to actually leave because the threat of leaving will so obviously succeed that they have to be nicer to you.
So all of that is in relation to, how does that relate to the separation of economics and politics again? Is that like?
That I think it enforces a,
politics maybe?
People involved in politics will be very scared to overreach into economics because they know that people will just leave. It'll basically become, I think it'll become, not perfectly, but a far more voluntary relationship, and that people involved in politics will, and also keep in mind that they can't print their own money. Like, that's also going on in the background now. So it's not just about productive capital. It's in order to function politically at all, they need the support of productive capital, like, or just of enterprise in general, you know, creating jobs, creating revenue, creating taxable income, however you want to think of it. They need it to be successful, so they need to support it. They can't just print their own money as an alternative. And they also need to not piss it off, because if they piss it off, it'll leave, and then there's no option. So it's not just there's no money printing. It's like, oh shit, everyone who is actually doing anything worthwhile and propping everything up has disappeared. The end.
Yeah.
It won't get to that point because that threat will be so obvious.
Well, maybe it doesn't get to it everywhere. Maybe it gets into it, gets to that
point. Oh, sure. Yeah. Sorry. This is like, exactly. This is 100 years. This is post hyper Bitcoinization. There's obviously going to be bumps on the way.
Totally. So I guess that to me ties into what we were saying earlier about the quote unquote state starts to function more like an actual enterprise that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
I don't think I quite agree with that. It maybe depends on what you mean. There might be different ways of interpreting that. I think there will still be, and this is, again, it's just back to like base social desires, regardless of, you know, what you can prove as a logical autist if you want to. People will want the state to have largely charitable functions. That's where its legitimacy will come from in the first place, I think. So that is the reason I'm not sure I object exactly, but I instinctively dislike using the word enterprise because that suggests that the only goal is profit and it doesn't really matter how that's achieved. I think an element of that will be true. I think it will have to be profitable, right? This is the key difference, right? Because again, it can't print its own money and it has to, you know, rely on actual productivity. But I wouldn't go as far as to say that. You probably weren't saying this anyway, but I was triggered by that word.
That's all right. Yeah, go ahead.
No, that's basically it. That is, I think it will remain a essentially different social institution. It won't be yet another business.
Let's pull on that then. So what are some of its more charitable functions in that case? Or what do you think will be some of the charitable functions that, like,
I'm using charitable very loosely, by the way. I'm not meaning the kind of things you donate to. By charitable, I just mean not commercial in the first place, I guess, something like that, like providing for law and order, running courts, having a. I don't think these kind of things are going to go away. I mean, it's entirely plausible that we get experiments where this kind of thing is done privately. And it might even work too. I don't think it's going to be all that common. That's more my point.
Yeah. I was actually funny. I was driving yesterday and I was thinking about this very thing. And I think, I mean, my working thesis, and I want to do a lot more reading and thinking about this, but my working thesis is that we move towards, you know, more like territories that are operated more like businesses, or like, you know, the
certainly
the
more kind of like businesses, yeah.
Yeah, more like businesses. But I also think that within the territories, basically those that will function best are those that also enable. So let's say, for example, within your territory, you have the standard policing contract. So Alan, you can come and move to Svetsky Land, and as part of your membership fee, you get, you know, basic policing cover. You get, you know, basic whatever, like fucking, I don't know. We protect the borders or whatever. But you have the option to hire an alternative provider for it, and just the very option itself existing means that me as the territory operator, you know, I need to behave more, I don't know, commercially minded to ensure that it just doesn't become like a bloated fuck up. And
I'm kind of skeptical of exactly that setup though, because why would you allow that in the first place? Why is it in the, you know, again, you know, keeping exactly the scenario going, right? You're the one who's in charge. Why is it in your interest to allow competition for the thing you're kind of
maybe I charge
a purpose in the first
place? Maybe I just charge a membership fee for competitors, so that way I outsource some of the work that is required for me to manage local law and order.
Because
local law and order has a meta benefit.
This is really interesting, because this has gone completely away from Bitcoin, and this is just getting into like hardcore political philosophy, basically. And again, for this at least, I don't feel particularly strongly about any of this. So I don't want, you know, listeners to go away thinking that, you know, this is what I think. But it is interesting to kind of play devil's advocate with it and just
Please
the thought experiment in the first place, because at least it's going to be better than that. Whatever it is going to be better than that. But I am skeptical of, and I think I can root this in quite a first principles way. I'm skeptical of the feasibility of locally competing systems of law and order, basically because somebody needs to actually win, right? Because ultimately they rely on violence, right? Hopefully you don't really dispute that too much or at all, that they, not just on violence, but on known to be effective violence. And I could probably go further. We can maybe come back to this if you want, but I think I'd argue even further than that, that that is a precondition for some, but not all, capital formation. And actually, it maybe ties nicely with what I mentioned before. It's probably precisely the capital formation that is necessarily immobile. The part that's mobile is fine. It's totally unaffected by this, or like mostly unaffected, but I don't see how you resolve two competing as police forces, let's say, right, who have both been commercially contracted to, you know, enforce whatever their customer's notion of justice is, but they essentially compete. And like, how, basically what I'm getting at is, how is that any different from gang warfare, which I would argue is bad?
Is there, what's a close precedent to that? Is like, you know, are there, you know, like state police versus local county sheriff versus federal police? Like,
maybe. I think I hesitate with this because I kind of want this to work. I think, like, I really want it to be the case that this kind of thing can be organized peacefully, right? That you basically don't need any state imposition of this sort of thing. And I'm not sure I'm even arguing that you do necessarily. It's more like I'm wary of the consequences of pushing it too far in the other direction, which seem equally bad, basically. I think maybe the thing with, like, you know, local, state, federal police, or however it works in some other jurisdiction, is that there's, not that I'm remotely an expert on this, but I would imagine there is nonetheless a hierarchy. Like, they basically don't actually fight each other, right? They don't come into conflict. They maybe, that kind of thing is worked out politically rather than by actually trying to, you know, directly enforce their preferred violence.
Interesting.
I feel like, I tell you what, I think this is maybe an interesting compromise that what I'd be absolutely fine with, and I think would be fantastic and not in conflict with any principles we've espoused, and definitely better than today, is, again, maybe just leaning back into core a little bit, that first of all, there are many, many more jurisdictions you can choose from in the first place. Maybe this is actually maybe what you were getting at when you set this problem up. So we might have just gone back to the start too, but they are in fact set up as businesses, or at least some of them are set up as businesses. You contract with them to protect you. But as I then suggested, they don't allow competition in their, you know, limited geographic area. So as to avoid this gang warfare problem, warfare problem. But again, there'd be an interesting dynamic nonetheless, because they would be providing that service, which is kind of inherently tied up with violence, and hence is, you know, makes all of this a little bit uncomfortable. But on the premise that, as we mentioned earlier, you know, you can just leave, and they know you can just leave. And so they're motivated to do it really well.
Yeah. So it's like a more local monopoly instead of like a fucking major, national or global monopoly. Yeah. Well, that's the other. Yeah, totally. And I think that's probably, I've toyed with this very much. So there's, Who was it that have you read any of what's his name now? He wrote Patchwork. He's like he's a pretty brutal writer. Mencius Molbug.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So he kind of
everyone's talks read him and no one admits it.
Yeah. He's fucking hilarious. He's such a good writer. But you know, he talks about it in Patchwork, right? And it really like grinds you, particularly like, you know, he grinds the whole libertarians and stuff like that, because it's like, look, you know, the local territory operator can, if he wants to, you know, basically subject everyone to torture, because, you know, he has the, you know, the monopoly right to operate his territory the way he wants to. But if he operates too economically backwards, then he will end up going bankrupt. That sort of ties into your point that
I'm pretty sure that my kind of take on this, I'm sure it owes a lot to Molbug. The only reason I hesitate on that is that I read him so long ago that I'm not sure I can trace it exactly. There's another one though that we've talked about before, as in you and I have talked about before, which is, it's kind of, or like the intermediate step is the sovereign individual. But via the sovereign individual, I discovered this absolutely amazing historian called Frederick Lane, which is, he's very heavily cited in the sovereign individual.
I bought
like three or four of his books, and he's just unbelievable. I won't go on like a whole, you know, lecture about him and his theory and so on. But the thing that I really like from him, which also reminds me of Molbug, although as far as I remember, Molbug doesn't reference Lane ever. They probably just arrived at similar ideas, is that, and it's also a reason that, as you said, right, Molbug pisses off the libertarians, because he basically kind of enjoys not caring about ethics or perceived ethics, and just being kind of, again, almost like logically autistic, but with a very sort of self-aware, ironic kind of tilt to it, about what is practically going to happen. And like, do you I guess I don't want to sound sort of overtly consequentialist, like, is the result good? But it's almost more the other way of thinking about it. It's like, well, if the result is clearly horrific, then you probably don't want it. Like, whatever it is, it doesn't matter how ethical it is. Frederick Lane, on the other hand, is nowhere, like, he's not a blogger, right? He's like an academic historian from the 30s through the 60s or something like that. But he has exactly the same approach, and it's really, really refreshing to read. It's also really nice with him. Like, I feel like he probably appeals to people a lot better than Moldbug does, because he's talking about primarily actually Venice. He's first and foremost a historian of Venice, which is another reason I enjoyed discovering him. But around the political economy of late medieval and early Renaissance, you know, Mediterranean Europe, right? The point of that being, though, that it seems so far removed from now that I don't think people will, like, really get offended by it in the way that, you know, obviously everybody's offended by Moldbug, which is why everybody else then pretends they have no idea who he is, even though they've read everything by him. But the thing that I like a lot about Lane, and I think is already, for those reasons, I think is more effective than Moldbug, is that he's just completely sort of sober and deadpan around how does violence work. And so one of his things, and this is exactly what they cite in The Sovereign Individual, I'm not sure if they use this exact language or not, but one of his things is that violence tends to local monopoly. I'm pretty sure that's the exact expression that Lane uses, and I just think he's right. Basically, I don't see how, no matter how you feel about that, right, no matter what your ethical attitude to it is, I don't see any way of overcoming that with economics or with, you know, with Bitcoin or whatever, or any kind of social institution. It just seems like it's kind of true. It's like a fundamental, again, it's like a fundamental fact of social life, right? Like, violence is bad, and it's also locally monopolistic. And you can almost, I feel like you can almost prove that logically, which is, it's a bit wary for something that's like essentially social science, but just by saying something like, okay, well, if you don't have a local monopoly on violence, then you almost by definition have a lot of violence. And given that it's violence you want to avoid, that maybe you should have a local monopoly so that you don't have lots of, I'm joking, obviously, it's not really like a logical proof, but I'm pretty sure I agree with Lane. I'm pretty sure I agree with Moldbug. I wish it wasn't true. I think Bitcoin at least makes it a lot better, but I don't think it removes that unfortunate reality.
So, yeah, I think what was Frederick Lane the one that you sent me that he kind of came up with the terminology around returns to violence?
Yes. Yeah. That's okay, him.
Yeah.
He's great.
I remember. Yeah. Okay, cool. I need to, I actually had that essay open and I started a page and then life took over and I never actually finished that, as it does. But yeah. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Cause I, as you said, I enjoyed Moldbug's work, but most people want to, you know, avoid. Did you ever read the piece he wrote? I think he wrote it in 2008 under a pseudonym called John Law, and he basically.
Oh no, I don't think I'm aware of that.
Yeah, he basically fucking described Bitcoin in 2008.
Really?
Yeah, under a pseudonym. That's good for John him. Law. So it's a very interesting piece. I want to go back and read it again, actually, but it's one of those like mind-blowing ones, you know, it's like a rabbit hole thing. It's, you know, who was Satoshi, blah blah blah. But anyway, it's one of those interesting pieces.
I have a quick I'm just googling this quickly so I get the name right so people can find it. A very funny anecdote about my introduction to Moldbug, which is I'm pretty sure is highly, highly unusual. So my dad told me about him in, I think it must have been either 2009 or 10. Okay. That makes sense given the timeline. I don't remember exactly when though. But for the weirdest reason, which was that I was complaining to him that I didn't like what we were, so I was in high school at the time. I didn't like what we were studying in our English classes, in like English literature class, because I had this almost like philosophical problem with the way it was being studied, which is, it was some poem, I don't remember what the poem was. And I was saying like, there's the way we're studying it and the way we're being made to talk about it and write about it presupposes that the poem is good. And I swear to God, the poem is so shit. So I don't know like what I'm supposed to, like, I just object to the whole thing. And so he sent me this, I think, not at all well-known Moldbug piece, which I've now found, which is called, I don't actually know how you pronounce the guy's name, but I'll just go for it. Tryfon Tolides. So I'll just spell that. TryfonTolides. So Tryfon Tolides, colon, an almost pure empty poetry. So we don't need to talk about this now. I just want to get it in so people can go find it. It is so, so funny. It's unbelievable. I make a point of rereading this every like year or two at most. And it's hilarious because it's like basically nothing to do with the rest of his thesis. Apart from, I mean, I've opened it now so I can see, okay, yeah, the first two paragraphs are leading in from his overall thesis. But the entire rest of it is just like absolutely destroying this horrific poet that he somehow discovered. But he's using, I don't want to ruin too much of it, but like he's using it as an example of how certainly poetry, but the arts in general, insofar as they're connected to universities, have just been corrupted completely beyond belief. But he does it, he only gets to the more like systemic stuff, I guess, far later in the post. The first like half of it or so is like, it's just decimating the guy's poetry. He's like, he's just going through, he just picks a handful of poems by this guy and explains in hilarious detail why they are awful. So anyway, yeah, that's how I discovered Moldbug, through poetry.
Interesting. Yeah, I actually discovered him through this young girl who super, super intelligent. She was on the pod like in, man, like early days, episode like 25 or something, episode 30. And she was kind of into complexity / libertarianism / other stuff. And she first mentioned him and I was like, okay, interesting. And she had some really, unconventional viewpoints for like a, I don't know, 23-year-old Canadian chick. And I was like mind blown, but I was like, what the fuck? And yeah, she introduced me to Moldbug and I was like, wow, where the fuck has this been all my life? He's brutal. He's hilarious. So if anyone listening to this,
you should read that one. You should let me know what you think of it.
Yeah, I will. I've added it. In fact, how long is it roughly?
Like, I don't think it's long at all. I mean, certainly not for him. Like, cause you know, he writes ones that like, he makes me look like nothing. He writes ones that takes you like 3 hours to read.
Yeah.
No, this is quite a short one by his standards.
Okay, cool. Yeah. I might even do a read of it on the pod. And we can discuss it in a future episode. So,
you want to have an episode that's just about poetry.
Totally. We totally should. Let's just rip into poetry. So Tryfon Tolides. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how you pronounce his name.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Whatever. We got 10, 15, 20 minutes to go here. So I want to wrap up with something and this is more from Bitcoin is Venice, less from your piece from the Bitcoin Times is, I was at a dinner last night with Matt Snow and what's his name? Chris Hunter from Galois. And we were talking about Bitcoin being a store of value. And I want to get your comments on this. Is Matt was kind of saying like, oh, you know, if the price kind of the 200-week moving average or whatever, 200-day week move, I don't give a fucking flying fuck about what price of Bitcoin is. But if that was undermined, or if that was, what's the word, like penetrated? No, it's the wrong word. Like disrespected. I don't know. Whatever. If it was like broken,
disrespected. You know, what does that mean? If like no coiners get really mad about it on Twitter?
No, I think it's like so. Basically, apparently,
if like some Bitcoin line trend thing crosses,
breaks, right? Exactly. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Then we're fucked. Like Bitcoin fails in its store of value premise, and. I took that personally. I was like, no, fuck you. Bitcoin doesn't fail in that sense. Like maybe, you know, one of your latest models is broken, but, you know, Bitcoin continues to function as a store of value. So I wonder how I should do this. I have a unique definition about store of value, particularly in relation to Bitcoin. So would you prefer me tell you my definition, then have you interpret that? Or do you want to tell me what your definition is?
At all, besides, I mean, if you remember, it's not in Bitcoin is Venice, it's in Wittgenstein's money. I am basically just like, I don't care. In a lot more words than that, but but yeah, sure, go for it. What's yours?
So my whole piece is the way I kind of generally perceive store value is some sort of proportionality, I guess.
Yeah.
And that's kind
that's
of
almost exactly what we say in Wittgenstein's money. Yeah.
Is it? Okay. That's one of the ones that I haven't read from you. So for me, the way I generally discuss it is that if store value is something to do with proportionality, and if you know your proportionality, you have some capacity to store the product of your labor in something. And because Bitcoin offers perfect proportionality, it is the perfect store of value. It's got nothing to do with the price. And I think this is worth illuminating, is because I think people misinterpret or misunderstand the Bitcoin store of value narrative. So they look at it in relation to Bitcoin being a place that people will, run to when shit hits the fan.
Oh, it's like a risk of asset or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think this has been really poorly conflated.
It's really silly. That could be true, but you're
at some point.
That's such a weird defense of it, though, because you're like, you're presupposing that you have some insight into the psychology of hedge fund managers. Like, what does that have to do with what we're talking about here? Like, it might be true, but like, who cares?
Mm-hmm. Well, I kind of think that version of store value, which is a tenuous version of it, maybe happens one day, but when Bitcoin genuinely starts to function like a risk off asset, that is when people are taking profits in Bitcoin, right?
Then
version of the definition of store value actually makes sense. But until then,
I think, to be honest, though, I would push that a bit further, though, that if we're at that point where it's so ubiquitous anyway, you probably don't think of it in terms of Bitcoin itself. You think of it in terms of
money.
Not even just money. I mean, yes, you think of it as money, but you wouldn't articulate it the way that you just did, because no one really thinks of, currently nobody thinks of dollars as the risk off asset. They think of treasuries as a risk off asset. So obviously that will kind of, that's a separate discussion about that, probably won't exist in the same way in the future. But what will exist is some or other, obviously not risk-free, I think that's the main difference, right? Not risk-free, but lowest risk Bitcoin denominated yield, that the price of that will change. That's how it will be reflected. It might be something like Lightning routing fees, for example. I think that makes some sense. I mean, this is getting a bit, speculative.
Bhatia talks about that, right? Isn't that sort of his whole thing? It's like, what does he call it? The, some sort of base rate of yield or something based on kind of the aggregate Lightning network.
Yeah, this rings a bell. I forget what he... I know what you mean, though.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. All right. So yeah, I wanted to get your comments on that, because I was listening to Guy Swan's read again of your Bitcoin is Venice piece. And there was a discussion in there around store of value you didn't elaborate on it as much, but it kind of seemed to be aligned with my thesis around this.
Yeah, no, definitely. So in Wittgenstein's money, it's basically the same. We talk about it there, in a sense that has very little to do with Bitcoin itself, because if anything, it's like that what's in the background is trying to debunk a really stupid way of thinking about money, which happens to be totally common anyway. And so the reason we introduce a proportionality argument is to make the following point, which is that if you take things like CPI is probably a good example, or any, I love that Saylor coined this expression. I find myself using it all the time now, metaphysical abstractions, right? These aggregate numbers that average over things that makes no sense to average over. And then CPI is even worse, because you're making qualitative decisions about what goes in the basket, blah, 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 blah. But people being, GDP as well. Maybe that's another good example too, which has many, if not all, of the same flaws. People being used to that kind of thing, I think, leads them to think of it making sense in the first place to talk about a store of value, or even just value in an absolute sense, like, because you can put a number on it. It's like, okay, well, if, you know, what CPI tells you is the exact rate at which the store of value is depreciating, right? So it's something along those lines. Whereas we set all of that up, but then the point we make is that this is basically incoherent in a world where things are actually changing anyway. So for example, say you had this obviously not completely realistic, but kind of dummy economy where, I don't know, there's one town, basically, there's one venue where economic activity happens. And then there's a hurricane, right? And like everything gets destroyed, or not literally everything, but there's an enormous amount of damage that is done, right? Now, clearly, in like the most basic terms possible, that will force production to be pulled back, because you just literally can't make the same things or the same number of things anymore. So supply will come way down and you'll get, you know, quote unquote inflation, but it won't be monetary inflation, right? Actually, you probably shouldn't even say you get inflation. Prices go up to reflect the new reality, right? Now, two questions. One, what does that have to do with money? It has absolutely nothing to do with money. It's about reality, right? So that's the sort of the fairly obvious one. But if you push this a bit further and you say something like, okay, well, in that situation, is your money serving as an effective store of value? And I think you can end up giving a really confused answer to that question if you believe in absolute value, rather than, first of all, to be clear, I don't mean there as, it's probably not the best expression now I think about it. I don't mean as distinct from subjective value. I don't mean like an objective valuation of things. I mean what you believe your money ought to be worth in the first point. I think the only coherent way to address that is your money is served perfectly well as a store of value if you are entitled to the same share of the output now as you were previously. And this is almost like not even a quality of money. It's like a quality of just thinking about these things clearly in the first place. Like, how could you possibly expect otherwise? You know, in that exact situation, right? If you have, say you put your number on it, right? Like, I demand that I have $10 worth of, I demand I have $1 million worth of purchasing power, right? And then you have the hurricane, and then less than $1 million worth of stuff is even being produced after that. How do you reconcile that? It's like, oh, I'm entitled to more than there is. Like, great. You're not. You're just deeply confused.
Yeah, that's a really good way of explaining that. So I wanted to trigger people and actually call this episode Bitcoin is not a store of value.
I thought you were gonna call it Bitcoin the God that succeeded.
Yeah, well I'll call the
Your essay series. Sorry, gonna save the triggering titles for where they're most appropriate.
I the boys suggested some really triggering titles last night, which I'm not going to mention on the podcast, but one last final question before we wrap this up. Who is Wittgenstein, and why is he important? And
this is hilarious because I always butcher the story. I'm just going to look it up because I have the link at hand. Not who he is, but the thing I'm about to tell. He was a philosopher. I think you probably typically describe him as a linguistic philosopher. So he made his primary contributions were in philosophy of language. He did some stuff around logic and kind of philosophy of maths. That stuff's a bit fluffier. Is more his contributions to language were more serious. He's usually considered, for people who are really nerdy about this stuff, he's one of the kind of unofficial founding members of the analytic school of philosophy, which is a very UK-centric phenomenon. So he is Austrian himself, but he went to Cambridge when he was quite young, and he did his PhD there under Bertrand Russell. The only reason I mention his name is for exactly the following story, which is at the beginning of Wittgenstein's Money. It's not relevant. I'm not actually tapping into any of his writing or philosophy or anything. I just like this as an analogy, right? So, and I'm going to read it because every time I try to do it off the top of my head, I get it all wrong. And then I'm like having to think about, no, he didn't say that. The other guy said that. No, but that wasn't what the other guy said. So we're going to avoid that because I've done that before on podcasts and it's been embarrassing. So you ready, right? Ludwig Wittgenstein once asked a friend, tell me, why do people say it is more natural to think that the sun rotates around the earth than that the earth is rotating? The friend said, well, obviously, because it just seems like the sun is going around the earth. Wittgenstein replied, well, what would it seem like if it did seem like the earth were rotating? And so then the way I use that is obviously to make fun of people who are like, oh, this can't possibly, this then leads into the whole, the completely sarcastic semantic theory of money. And therefore Bitcoin can't be money because it's not this. And like, it doesn't matter at all what's happening in the real world to the people who are making this argument. So my kind of rhetorical question back is like, okay, well, what would it seem like if it did seem like this was becoming money? And then the rhetorical answer is, well, it would seem exactly like it does seems like this, which is also the point of the original story, that he's like, he's kind of teasing his friend, because the answer is it would seem exactly like this, because this is what it seems like. You just don't know what you're looking at.
Yeah. Okay. That ties into something I wanted to do in the next episode, but maybe we can just touch on it here really quickly, is Bitcoin derangement syndrome, right? It's like, you've got these people who fundamentally, and I loved how you took the piss out of like the, you know, the, what's his name, gauge theory man and Taleb and stuff, but it's so fucking true. It's like the, you know, they're so busy quibbling about theoretical perfections that, you know, they miss this thing that seems to be doing everything that they otherwise talk about. But just not doing it the way they want to, or something like that. So, I mean, I asked Breedlove about particularly the Weinstein one. It's like, you know, why? And Breedlove's kind of was at a loss of words. He's like, I don't fucking get it. Like, he's always trying to trap me with some sort of overly complex philosophical argument. And, you know, he's like, I can always sense I'm being trapped, but he's really smart, so I don't know what to do about it. So what's your thoughts around like why this Bitcoin derangement syndrome seems to infect these people?
Oh, goodness. I don't think I have a well-formed theory on this. I think, at least straight off the bat, there's definitely more than one type of it, right? So I think Taleb is definitely very different to just, you know, run-of-the-mill Keynesian economics professor. I think that's probably very easily diagnosable, which is that, I mean, and this is kind of what at least the first, not chapter one, but chapter 2 through 5, I guess, of the book, is like, this is all bullshit. Like, everything you've ever learned is just it's a lie. And here's why, rigorously. So it's obvious why they're offended, because their racket is getting, you know, shut down.
Eroded. Yeah, exactly.
Or at least
maybe not
practically shut down, but it's like actually finally being taken on. Yeah. People like Taleb are just, it's a lot weirder with them, and Weinstein too. I mean, I honestly don't really know. I think you put it quite well, right? That they have their own, you know, theory of everything or whatever. But I don't think it's even that Bitcoin contradicts that. I think it's almost like it annoys them that Bitcoin even exists and is somehow different to what they've been talking about. Because I agree with you, it's weird, right? That, like, I mean, this has basically become its own meme, that everything Taleb has ever said is true about Bitcoin, except the things he said about Bitcoin, right? And it's even true with Weinstein too, because, like, so he's, obviously I know a lot more about this because I spent a weekend like rigorously researching my upcoming debunking of him. But it's the same with him. Like, a lot of the things he's talked about, they fit very nicely. And I think the difference is probably just, it maybe just comes down to humility or something like this. I don't know exactly the right way to describe it, but it's almost like they have to remain the center of attention, right? They can't say, ah, yes, this other thing that I had nothing to do with, by the way, that's what I've been talking about this whole time. Because then people stop listening to them, right? So it's almost like they need to keep the illusion going that they are the source of all wisdom or something like that. I don't know. I'm just making all this up. It's kind of
I think the word,
their weird public behavior. I don't really know how either of them think.
I think the word humility is a good one. I kind of came to, I've been writing this, you know, whole series of Bitcoin articles through the lens of Jordan Peterson stuff. And you know, I was kind of toying with this idea of faith and humility recently. And I think it actually is, seems to be related to that in some way. It seems to be some sort of, like, without getting too religious, like, Bitcoin kind of, the humility piece is obvious, and I think you've described that, but the faith piece is interesting, is like, faith is almost this, I don't know, ability to stop poking and touching at things and kind of almost have the, you know, the irrational belief in a sense that that which either doesn't exist yet or that, you know, was maybe beyond you has kind of solved the problem.
I think I wouldn't even call it irrational though. Like, I'd maybe link it to what we were talking about quite a while ago in the inherent, I forget exactly how I phrased it, but something like the inherent goodness of local, or no, the inherent merit, I think is what I said, of local culture. I think these are very similar, both in terms of like the psychological phenomena that they represent, but also like actual historical overlap in a lot of cases that I'd say are maybe abusing the word faith and adjusting slightly how you meant it in a religious sense. But I think you can have a very similar kind of faith in a cultural practice, which actually, for sake of argument, may also be a religious practice, right? In that you get to the state of being okay with not understanding exactly why it works, but nonetheless knowing that it works.
Yeah.
It's very true. There's a line, like we have this in the introduction to, I think it was in the original Bitcoin is Venice essay, and then we moved it to the introduction because it's like too important in the book, that is the Jameson Lopp quote. I mean, the quote I think is also the title of the entire article, that nobody understands Bitcoin and that's okay.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's, for me, that's probably the two words that it boils down to, humility and faith, which, yeah.
I think do you want to know something really funny, actually? So Sasha and I were talking about this recently because we're going to start, we were obviously busy with Miami for a while, but we're going to start promoting it and like going on podcasts more. And we were thinking like, we're actually not, I'm glad you didn't ask me this. I don't know. We talked more about this one extract rather than the book as a whole, but we don't really have a good answer on like, what is the book about? Just like, I don't know, like Bitcoin, maybe capitalism, culture. I don't know. It's kind of about everything. philosophy. I don't know. But Sasha went away and thought about it, and he came back and came up with a hilariously concise answer, which I do want to use this and just like see how people react. It's like, right, I can tell you what the book's about in two words, right? Uncertainty and humility. That's it.
Beautiful. Beautiful. I think...
now you don't need to read it.
That's it. Yeah. you walk away humbled and uncertain about the future. now look, that's a good way to wrap up this section, my friend. Thank you. Thank you for coming on. And
thank you very much for having me. It's been great.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, it's always, having a discussion with you is always one of those, like you have to think. It's not just, run of the mill conversations. So I really appreciate it.
We can try one where we don't have to think if you want. That can be like an experiment. With
Nah.
If we do the poetry one, you're definitely going to have to think.
I want to, in the next, in the next round, I actually half jokingly, but half realistically wouldn't mind going through the poetry thing just for shits and giggles, but
we'll have to think in advance if we can tie it at all to the book. Maybe we can, I wouldn't be surprised.
I mean, I'm sure you can tie just about anything to anything these days. Like Bitcoin seems to like, I mean, well, yeah. In today's day and age, you can tie literally anything to anything, but whatever. Do you have any final comments to say before I click stop?
I buy the book, I guess. Everybody listening, go buy it. It's awesome.
It's on Amazon now, right?
Yeah, it's on Amazon. Good point. Sorry, I should have mentioned all this anyway. It's on Amazon. You can buy it. If you want to pay in Bitcoin instead, you can buy it from Bitcoin Magazine. You can get a Kindle version from Amazon. There will pretty soon be a completely free PDF that I'll just put on my site. People can download and I'll like tweet about it a lot, so you won't miss it. The only reason we haven't released that yet is that we're also publishing a bunch of extracts on Bitcoin Magazine and we want to finish them. I think there's like maybe 4 or 5 left. I don't think there's that many left and they come out once a week. So before too long, there'll be a completely free version as well.
Awesome.
But I should say though that the a reason to get a physical copy, aside from, I mean, I far prefer just having physical books anyway, but all of the profits are going to the Bitcoin Development Fund at the Human Rights Foundation. So I'm not making any money from this book. So you're doing a good thing if you buy it.
A good thing is presupposed by Alan doesn't get anything. Yes.
An objectively it's good thing.
All right, my friend. Well, thank you. I'll put all the links in the show notes and cool. People can find that. And yeah, man, I look forward to our next conversation.
Me too.
Thank you for listening to the Wake Up Podcast. Find us on the Fountain app and send us a boost with a comment. I'll try and read them each week and send you a shout out. And remember to grab a copy of the Uncommunist Manifesto and join us in defeating the plague that is consuming our world.